Good morning. This is Monica Cornetti. Welcome to Gamification Talk Radio. We air this program every Saturday morning so that you who are interested in learning more about gamification and how you can use it in your business or organization, on your work team, as an instructional designer, whatever part of the organization for which you play a role, and you want to learn more about this great strategy of gamification, this radio program is for you. Now, today's program is actually the first part of a two-part series on knowing versus doing. See, what I have found is that training isn't always the answer. Now, that may seem like heresy for someone who makes her living in gamification design and delivery, and yet, haven't you found that too often there's talk about performance and we're not talking about actions? Too often we offer training solutions for problems that we, as the people who are in the learning and development program or the instructional designers, we know that it's not necessarily training related, yet we start talking training solutions. And we know better, but for reasons that are often, but not always, but often they're out of our control, we revert to what's comfortable and what's expected, and we've got deadlines and we've got restricted budgets. But there are many reasons why people don't perform. In my leadership workshops that I deliver for clients, I always bring it back to, is it a question of, is it that they can't do it or they won't do it? Are they not motivated to do it, or do they not know how to do it? If they don't know how to do it, that's a can't. If they're not motivated to do it or they don't do it, then that's a won't. And that comes down to, you know, different motivators or two types of motivators that cause people to take actions, extrinsic and intrinsic. In successful gamification, extrinsic and intrinsic motivators, they're not polar opposites of each other. It's not like, well, that's an extrinsic motivator, bad. That's an intrinsic motivator, good. Just use those. They're not opposites. Instead, they're codependent on each other. And the best combination is a balance of the extrinsic and the intrinsic motivation. And when you think about the can't and the won't and the knowing versus doing, it brought me back to a recent interview I conducted with Jonathan Peters, PhD, on Dr. Rees and the Rees profile, or the 16 motivators, and how those are applied to learning and development when adding gamification to your instructional design. That's where this overlay of the Rees profile into player types and motivators becomes very helpful. Let me just give you a brief profile on the guest today. Jonathan Peters, PhD, he holds a master's certification in the Rees profile. Jonathan's an international speaker and writer. He's spoken before audiences from Melbourne, Australia to Augusta, Maine. And his specialty is marketing and customer experience. So helping audiences improve and identify what motivates their customers and learning how to speak towards those motivators. Jonathan's authored four books, including Caveman Can't Market, which is the first in his Caveman trilogy. And he's also a ghostwriter. So he's ghostwritten over 31. I think that number last I heard is up closer to 40 now. Ghostwritten 40 nonfiction books. He's also, in his spare time, an adjunct professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and he instructs senior-level business majors there. All right, so let's just get going first. What's your number one takeaway from that master certification event?
Well, my main takeaway was just how scientific the whole Rees motivator profile is. I had studied, obviously, had studied the 16 motivators. But unlike any other personality style that's out there, Dr. Rees has done a significant amount of scholarly work. At this point, he has over 80,000 participants, essentially data set of over 80,000 people in four different continents, all the sorts of different cultures. So unlike, say, the personality profiles like the Myers-Briggs and the DISCs, those were all based on just some ideas back in 1924 that never actually been scientifically studied. and they feel good, they sound right, but that doesn't necessarily make them right. So as a tool, the 16 motivators, unlike anything else that's out there, is very, very scientifically based. So when we talk about different aspects of, like, say, employee engagement and all the other onboarding and training, it's to realize that this isn't just a feel-good or something that sounds right. It has a lot of science behind it. So that's encouraging when you're, in my case, working very, very closely with the 16 motivators.
When you say it's got the science behind it, you brought out an interesting point in one of the conversations that we had, and it's one of those things that I had to think about for a little bit. But oftentimes when people are promoting their theory or promoting their latest book, for example, they'll say things like, scientists say, and then they'll go off on whatever their platform is that they're promoting. And one of the things that I had that aha moment is it's a whole lot different to have scientific research than it is to have a scientist say. I mean, those are two different things completely. And is that what when you're talking about how scientific it is, you're basing it on that he actually has scientific research, not just hearsay from other people. Isn't that right?
Yeah, and it's consistent across all the cultures. So if you take someone says, well, this is what motivates the workforce, yeah, it motivates that a specific set. It might be more motivating than, say, giving them a raise or something. But with everybody being different, because it's not what Dr. Reeves found is we have these 16 motivators. It's not that we have them or don't have them. The difference is how much do we want of any one thing. Well, for instance, a good example that I've been using, say, social contact is one of the motivators. If we're highly motivated, we want lots of it. Society gives us, let's say, 60% of our time for dealing with other people, whether at work and just basic interaction. As someone who's highly motivated by social contact, let's say I want 80% more time, and so I am going to develop certain characteristics and personalities traits that get me that extra 20%. So I'll learn a sense of humor. I'll learn to be polite. I'll learn to shower, comb my, well, I don't have hair, but to groom, and these types of things to make me more attractive and make it so that people want to be around me. But on the other side, if someone's not highly motivated by social contact, let's say they only want 40% of their day, but society's given them 60% of their day, they're going to engage in behaviors that push people away from them. So they'll be mean and surly and short and argumentative, and they'll make sure that they don't dress well and that their hygiene is less than pleasant so that people won't walk up to them and talk to them. The problem is, as trainers and business leaders, when we get those folks on our team, what we do is we send them to seminars and training so that they learn to be more friendly, but this will never motivate them because what we're giving them is a skill set that brings to them what they don't want. They don't want more people in their life. So learning to be nice and gracious won't stick because we're working against their core motivators, their core values. They don't want more people in their life.
Right. So we in the workplace will design a training then. So we think, oh, we're going to make this. And in fact, you'll bring it to me and I'll gamify it for you. So I'm going to gamify a training on how to communicate with tact and professionalism. It'll be fun. It'll be engaging. We'll have chance cards, competitions. They'll get to pick an avatar, all this great stuff that will be really fun. But training isn't really going to change that because no matter how much we train them and provide them with the tools that would help them develop the skills, their motivator's not there. So are you saying no matter how hard we train, it's really not going to make a difference, or how great the training is, or how well it's gamified?
We just have to appeal to the different a motivator for them, so that would be the only way to look at it. But it really is that if we're needing them to be friendly, we can't change who they are. Ultimately, we can't change who they are. We just have to appeal to the other motivators. what other motivators they might have. And games is a way to do that, because it's not just you or me or any trainer just saying, get your act together, here's some skill sets.
So then the secret is to not try to necessarily make them more social, which is what we're typically doing and I'm going to keep going back to just that, how to communicate with tact, because that's, you know, or dealing with difficult people. Our goal shouldn't then be, when we're looking at what's our objective for the training, if our objective is to make them more social, then we'll fail, because that probably isn't going to happen. We have to go back to our objectives are, we have to have a work team that can achieve the goals that have been given to us as a work team. So we have to hit a certain level of productivity or profitability. So if being social isn't going to be an element of that, then how can we as a team still hit those goals we've been given and still have some kind of cohesiveness as a work team and find those motivators that will make that work? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, essentially. In that case, the person, if it's vital that they have lots of contact with somebody and with people, and they don't want it, then they're just in the wrong place. So by focusing on other things, if it's not mission critical, like you're saying, that they have contact with people and that they're nice to people, then it's good. We can still succeed. But if they're customer service or if they're in sales and marketing, they're in the wrong spot. We need to move
okay.
them somehow.
So then it goes back to, now, when you were there at the certification to get certified to actually administer the Reese profile, is that correct? So
Yeah.
Okay. So now you're certified, you can administer the profile. So it sounds to me like what I hear you saying is, if I need a specific type of person, and I don't mean to like stereotype or categorize, but we know that to be successful as a, let's say, customer service, that I need to be outgoing. I need to be have a certain amount of friendliness, or, and I'm not even sure what the exact motivators would be here, or amount of need to be around people or to talk to people, to communicate, to be social. So it sounds to me like it would be a good idea to administer the Reese profile in my hiring process as I'm bringing them on. If I find somebody who's low socially motivated, they might be a great fit for me in accounting or in programming, or again, not trying to stereotype, but not necessarily for my customer service.
Yeah, and it's not stereotyping. It's just that we're better at certain things. Tall people do better at basketball than short people. So it's just who we are. And, yeah, so we can draw those conclusions. And Dr. Reese has done that in the military. The military uses his profile to see who's likely to have an anxiety attack, who's likely to have post-traumatic stress syndrome. He believes that he can predict which high school students will engage in school violence. You know, these things are in our being. So we would look at, say, customer service. We would want high interdependence so that work together as a team, support the company. Even if you had social contact as high, you'd still would want to make sure they're not independent, because then they might take your customers and go somewhere else or recommend a different product for your customer. So it's not as easy as one profile. It's the combination that we would be looking for in any one position. So it could be, as long as they weren't low in it, then we'd be safe. And so, yeah, of course, it would be better to bring them on ahead of time, you know, to run the profile before we actually hire them to make sure they're in the right spot. Otherwise, we'll have conflict. We just will.
Right. So let me ask you a question then. I'm not sure I'm using the right terms, but can we profile positions then? So, you know, we always talk about profiling. Using the Reese profile before we actually administer it, would we be able to say the ideal applicant for this position, their profile will have scores between X and Y on the high or low end in these certain motivators? Could we create that kind of profile?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so we would know what we were looking for.
Okay. So let's say, though, that we didn't use, because this is one of those new tools when you're looking at, we didn't use the Reese profile, we didn't do any kind of necessarily profiling for this position. We needed a person, this person seemed to be a good fit. They either walked the walk or talked the talk that we were looking for, so we put them in, and now we find that, no, they really aren't ideal. They wouldn't fit the profile. So what do we do now, though? How do we motivate them? Can we motivate them? What can we do through training to get them to do what we need them to do?
And, yeah, anytime it's in that situation, that's where, first of all, we have to realize what our motivators are so we know where our blind spots are when we're trying to motivate someone else. But at that point, then it's appealing to their higher motivators. So it's all of us will do something unpleasant to get something that we want or that we desire. And so that's where we use it, especially in training. So let's say curiosity is one of the motivators. So if we were in a game situation or even just traditional training, if someone's low in curiosity, we wouldn't want to have a lot of reading and lecturing because that's not what they want. But they will do the reading and lecturing, go through that experience if it appeals to a higher motivator, like the desire to win or the desire to exert one's will. So we can create training environments, that's where the gamification comes in, where we can appeal to other motivators and still accomplish the task that we're trying to accomplish.
So when you're looking at different types, so I know I listened to a recording this morning that Dr. Reese was doing. It was, I think, from last year. It was on NPR, and Daniel Pink was also on there, and they were just talking about different motivators. But Dr. Reese said something interesting, and I'm going to kind of paraphrase and maybe not get it exactly accurate, but he was talking about athletes and motivating athletes, and he said he did kind of stereotype them or group them. He said athletes are one of their biggest motivators is family and children. So when talking to athletes, you want to talk about how they can influence and impact children's life and the people who see them as heroes and want to be like them. And so to get them to do what you need them to do, he kind of, and I know it's not 100%, but he said it like so black and white that it was athletes are family oriented. Athletes are motivated by motivating children. And so when you look at different categories of people per se in the workplace, can we kind of start grouping like this once we get more familiar with the profile? Like this group is typically motivated by these things?
Yeah, and that's what, when Dr. Reese says things like that, it's because he's done the research. And this is across the board. I got to see a grouping where they were looking at a team and then in looking at the different profiles inside of there, and you can determine who's going to succeed, who's going to struggle, and so on, just because of looking at their profile. And so we can definitely do that because that's what he's showing. Once we know how someone is motivated, now we're talking individual, so when it's training, it's a little more difficult because we don't know who the audience is. If we're setting up a training, we don't necessarily know who the individuals are. But on the individual side, if we know what motivates them, we can predict their behavior because we know that they're going to want more of something or less of something, and they will engage in behaviors to get more or less of whatever that motivator is. So it can be a predictive tool in the sense that on the individual level, when you're saying stuff like, well, it's not 100%, it's just because people are people, and if we're talking to a group, there won't necessarily be a common denominator. I mean, there might be a common denominator inside that group, and that's what we would want to look for in the training and in the hiring process.
Right. I mean, like, so if you're talking about, like, chefs, for example, you can assume that all chefs have a high food motivation. They wouldn't spend their lives working with food if they weren't motivated by food. That would be a thing, right? And so, I was watching some of the Olympic trials last night, and these snowboarders are going down and doing these loops. And so it might be safe to assume that snowboarders all have, like, what would that be, an adventure or risk-taking? Or what would that motivator be?
It's low tranquility, So they're actually motivated by not having a lot of safety in their life. So great adventure. Yeah.
So, I mean, again, it's you know, not 100%, but I think it's pretty safe to assume that somebody who's willing to go down this huge mountain at, I don't even know what the miles per hour, do a couple 360s in the air between the different levels, that most of those people would have a low tranquility. So in our language to them, if we were trying to market to them or work with them as a group, we would use low tranquility language to motivate them. Is that right?
Yeah, in other words, if you were their coach and you wanted them to not take those risks, that you wanted to make sure that they were healthy and that they were going to survive the Olympics and the Olympic trial process, you wouldn't use language like safety and security and things like this, because they're actively working against not having a lot of safety and security in their life. So while it might be the coach's motivator, because the coach wants to get the team there, wants to have his or her job still available a year from now, so want survivable athletes, you wouldn't want to appeal, if you're the coach, you wouldn't be appealing to what's important to you, you'd appeal to what's important to them. And so you wouldn't use those words. You might use success words. We would assume power would be one that they would have. So, you know, you would use self-restraint type things. You know, we need to save ourselves so we can compete at this next higher level. And so you'd change the terms. But and that's an example of appealing to a higher motivator to get a lower, to get a behavior that is not a motivator for them.
So even, I was just thinking of my boys, I have three boys who are in their mid-20s now. I used to always say the same thing as they were leaving the house. Remember who you are, make good choices. But that's just like a standard catchphrase that may or may not have motivated them at all. Yeah, mom. You know, just. But if I had thought really through what their motivators are, I could have picked words that maybe would have had an impact on some of the choices they made. Is that what I'm learning 20 years late?
Sorry, I've accepted what they would believe as a good choice. What they would believe as a good choice would actually, they would believe it was a good choice, and you might think it was a bad choice. They would think it was a good choice because, for them, that's their value, because their motivators are different. And so that's where the values of where this comes into play and what we pursue in life is, it's not, you might think I'm making a bad choice, but I'm actually making a good choice based on my motivational profile.
Right, and that you can even bring that into the workplace because, as you know, I have a book coming out in March called What Were You Thinking? And it's based on some of the experiences I've had. And, I mean, like, I can't make up stories that are as good as what I hear in some of my workshops and keynotes and talking with members of the audience. Like, so, like, a manager is doing a class on creative thinking and tells their people, you know, to think outside the box, make good choices, and real case example was an employee at a front desk at a hotel. The guest got in like middle of the night, had already checked in, but came back in at like 3 a.m, didn't have the key. The person behind the desk, instead of like making another key or finding security, gave the guest a screwdriver to go around the outside to take the screen off the window so they could crawl through the window to get in their room. Now, to the employee, they were making a good choice because their manager had just done a training with them on thinking outside the box, being creative. To the manager, or any person even listening to this radio program, all we can say is, what were you thinking? How could that possibly have been a good choice? To that person, it made sense. It was a good choice. So we have to make sure that the language is lining up with, is this going to help us achieve our objectives? So how can we even attempt to get this when you're working with teams of people, Jonathan? How can you be making sure that you get the right language out there to get what you need?
Yeah, and that's where it takes, I always say it takes self-knowledge first, because where we're surprised, what Dr. Reese called self-hugging, we believe whatever motivates us not only motivates other people, but ought to motivate other people. And it's difficult for us to see or to anticipate where, like in the situation you were saying, it would be difficult to anticipate that someone would say, take a screwdriver and go around the other side. But if we knew that our style was in a certain way, then we can anticipate how other people might be. So we could make some generalizations on who's probably on our team, or if we're more familiar with the Reese profile, then we would know, or we could have a good idea of who's there. But first, to understand where our blind spots are, once we understand where our blind spots are, then we can anticipate where we might get surprised, where other people might be motivated differently, so that any of the profiles, so that the one we are using to start the program on the social contact, I'm surprised that people don't want to go hang out in a, you know, the bar and coffee shop and just start talking to random strangers. That just shocks me that wouldn't be a fun activity for most people. So I could anticipate, once I understand that about myself, I can anticipate that there are people that don't want to do that and won't be motivated by it and don't want to play a game or even have a conversation. So it begins with a little self-knowledge and then anticipating our teams, but then where would there likely to be conflict in the motivations or what we're wanting them to get done, and then be able to appeal to what's likely to be their higher motivators.
Now, we're going to run out of time, but I want to just go back and hit one thing. So let me just say this, that you are now certified to administer the test. So this is something that when people are looking to hire or to even do a team development or strategic planning, I can just imagine how this starts to reduce and perhaps even totally eliminate conflict in the workplace, because once you understand that that's somebody's low motivator and you really get it, then you don't have to be upset with them when they don't respond in a way that you think they should respond. Because I wanted to cycle back, so let me just get you answer that question first. People can contact you about administering the test, the profile with their team. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So can you not see it like eliminating conflict or getting the right hire? So you said something about, what if my motivator is something high, like I have a high food motivator. I like to know what I'm going to eat, when I'm going to eat it. I'm, you know, trying to eat healthy, and so I have to kind of like judge if I'm going to be somewhere where it's not going to be healthy. I need to make sure I reduce my calorie intake or something, or exercise more. So I'm real high motivated by that. So I spend time planning that. And I think that others should be that way too. As soon as I think that others ought to be that way, that's when I'm going to get in trouble, right?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so if we understand then that, well, you have a low food motivator, so you're not thinking about meal planning and when we're going to do what, I don't have to get upset by that. I don't have to think, well, you have to be like me. I just understand, well, that's a low motivator. So if I need us to do something planning-wise, well, what would motivate you? And I don't see this as manipulation at all. I just see it eliminating conflict. I think those are two different things entirely. Do you agree?
Yeah, and it's because it can be that way. It's an example. A good general example is I'm not motivated by food and highly motivated by social contact. So therefore, eating is an extremely enjoyable experience for me, not because it's food, but because it's social contact. It's appealing to a higher motivator with the experience of eating, as an example.
You can reach out to Jonathan. His website is jonathanpetersphd.com. You can see that link right below in the information about today's radio program. One last thought, Jonathan, before we wrap it up.
My new motivational speech is, don't change who you are, change where you are. Don't try to change who your employees are, change where they are working, change their environment.
When you look at the no versus do, we can see already that gamification certainly has many benefits, but we can also see that when we apply it in some kind of haphazard way, just saying, hey, this isn't doing what we want, let's do some training, hey, let's gamify it, yeah, then we encounter all kind of dangers. Making smart decisions about how to gamify diminishes the risk of negatively impacting your workers. And in fact, because there's so many people who are interested in looking at how to leverage gamification, we are actually rolling out a gamification certification starting in February. So Jonathan will be back with us next week and give us more in-depth information on how to use the REACH profile and the 16 motivators as an overlay in your gamification design. Thanks, everyone. Have a great week. Have fun.